Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you sun in the air.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. On the show today, I'm really excited about this show, actually. We're talking bi-coastal here, actually. We're going to be doing a phone interview. But we're talking about something that's really exciting, a new product to the spirits market that, you know, I can't remember the last time something like a new actual base spirit came out. I probably wasn't alive when it happened. But to talk about that today on the show, we have on the phone Clay Gordon of The Chocolate Life. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Damon, for having me on the show today.
Yeah, you used to actually be on Heritage Radio a while back, right?
That's right. I had a show called Straight for the Source. I finished up about this time last year. I've been taking some time off, sort of re-energizing the batteries, thinking about what I might do and how to refocus it to make it more interesting and more relevant and to just increase the amount of fun everybody's having doing the show.
Yeah, I think we actually I remember meeting you before at maybe one of the host events, or maybe we were just passing through. But
I was the show. I was the show that was on before you on Wednesday.
Right, on Wednesdays. Yeah, cool. Well, okay. It's good to catch back up.
Well, it's great to be back on the air on Heritage Radio Network. I definitely do miss it, and I'm looking forward. I ran into Aaron Fairbanks, who is out here in San Francisco.
Oh, great.
for the Good Food Awards and for the Fancy Food Show. And that's how we reconnected, and I think that's how she introduced me to you and why it is that I'm talking to you today.
Absolutely, and I just saw her on the street.
Yeah.
Cool, man. So you've been pretty busy with this new spirit category. It's called Solbeso.
Yes, Solbeso, yes.
Solbeso. And it's made from the pulp of the cacao fruit, right?
Yeah. Yes, it is. And you're right. It's the first new base spirit that we know of that's been introduced in something like 200 years.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy when you think about that.
It's a new kind of fruit that's never been used for. No, we're not using sugar cane. We're not using grapes. We're not using pears. We're not using
grain.
Corn.
Yeah.
We're not using any form of grain. So what we're doing is we're taking the liquid that drains off the pulp during the primary fermentation of cocoa beans. So this is something that's been happening for thousands of years. Literally tens of millions of liters of this juice are allowed to just flow out on the ground. And we capture that early on before wild fermentation kick in, and we use it as the source for our own special fermentation and then distillation.
So, like, up until this point, what you're saying is it was a byproduct of basically harvesting cacao that was never used for anything else.
Well, that's basically never used commercially.
Right. Okay.
There are moonshiners, you know, in the rainforest in places like Peru and Ecuador and Brazil, and they've got their stills and they're making it for themselves. But it probably more closely resembles something like an aguardiente, rather than a nice smooth distilled spirit, the one that we've created in Solbeso. And there's one small producer in West Africa who's known. He is a cacao grower, and he has this fabulous chocolate bar where he takes raisins and he soaks them in his cacao distillate and then uses those raisins in a chocolate bar.
Oh, that's neat.
But he only makes a small amount, and he gives it to friends and family for holidays and things like that. He doesn't sell it commercially, no.
Right, so this is the first commercially produced and distributed version of this this alcohol, this spirit.
This product. Yep. Yeah. And absolutely. Absolutely.
So to me, that I, you know, I like many people, I actually carry it at my bar. I think it's a cool product. It drinks like somewhere between like a Pisco and like a Grappa or Eau de Vie. You know, it's got a lot of life to it. You know, and it's versatile. Like when you use it in like cocktail formats, it's cool on its own. It goes through a lot of different stages when you're tasting on its own, but it's really cool to use in different ways. I've been using it in a lot of punches lately. But you know, when I tell people what the base spirit is in this punch, you know, they're like, what the hell is that? You know, and so you have to like kind of like hold their hand and walk them through the, but like, the, you know, I give them my explanation, you know, of what it is. And, they, you know, people, it is really hard for a lot of people to, grasp, you know, a new spirit category. You know what I mean?
No, actually it's something we struggle with every day. You know, the idea for Sobeso came to a gentleman by the name of Tom Higby. Tom has been involved in spirits innovation for most of his career, and has been responsible for creating and helping launch a number of very well-known brands from a number of well-known companies. He was on a trip in Peru four and a half years ago, where he saw all this liquid draining on the ground, and he said, fruit fermenting, I should be able to distill that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the supply chain to make it all happen did not exist. It needed to be created from scratch. You actually have a very narrow window of opportunity for when you open the cacao pod until the time that the liquid has started spontaneously fermenting and oxidizing.
Right.
And the level of sugar is below a point where it's usable, and you start generating off flavors and things like that. So working with the growers in country to be able to develop specific methods of capturing the juice while it's still fresh was just the first in a large number of technical hurdles that needed to be overcome.
It seems like it had to be an immediate process. Like as soon as the cacao beans are husked, you have to like take that product and get to work on it, right?
Pretty much. The same day.
Yeah.
The same day, yeah. You want to have the liquid into the fermenter the same day that the pods have been opened. Yep.
Yeah.
And when you have lots of smallholder farmers who live a 2 or 3 or 4 hour walk or drive from a collection center, and they have been used to doing their own fermentation of 20 and 30 and 40 kilogram batches of the beans that they harvested, it represents just this really challenging distributed supply. And so we work with producer cooperatives, where, they have, centralized collection capabilities.
Yes. It seems like a logistical, you know, kind of almost like a logistical nightmare, but it's, you know, I feel like you would almost have to start up a compilation service, you know, before you even get to work on the actual like making of the product, just acquiring all of the product from all these different farms, you know.
No, it's very, very much the case. I mean, so as a matter of fact, what happens is if anybody has spent any time in country working with farmers and the cacao farmers are just one example. The techniques that we use to collect the juice are different from country to country, and different from region to region. So we can't go into, the more we say do it our way, the less likely it's going to happen when we're not there. So we actually have to look at the ways they're currently doing it and say pretty much, to people, what we want you to do is we want you to focus on the fact that every little drop of that liquid can make you money before you just let it drip on the ground.
Right.
But we want you to start thinking about, okay, how do you capture this so when you get it to this collection center, right, you can make money. And the more you get and the faster you get it there, the more valuable your crop is to you.
Right.
So that's just one part of it. And then methods to be able to maximize how much juice we can extract without actually affecting, and in some cases improving, the fermentation quality of the cocoa beans. What we do doesn't have any effect on the cocoa itself, and it can still be used to make chocolate. So this is a virtuous circle, you know, in every respect.
And it seems like, well, I mean, there's, you know, yeah, like you said, it's not affecting the cocoa to make the chocolate, you know, at all, because it's just, it's basically a byproduct of the harvesting of that product, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's something that has been wasted for as long as anyone has been making chocolate, right? Mostly wasted, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are roughly 4 million metric tons of cocoa that are harvested every year. And just, you know, a rough rule of thumb says we might have 800 million liters a year of raw juice that just goes onto the ground.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. And to think about the origin of distillation, or, you know, making cheese or making charcuterie, and just like, it's basically preserving the crops, you know, and like, it, you know, mm-hmm. You know, we make so much bread, but then it's like we have this grain left over. Well, let's, you know, figure out a way to keep it rather than letting it spoil. So it's kind of crazy to me that was left to spoil for so long. And maybe it was just one of those things that, you know, it took a while to get out there, you know, because
there's a history of using the spontaneous fermented alcohol in South America, like a 4 to 5% beer.
Okay.
So it was consumed, but it is the Europeans who introduced distilling technology mm-hmm. into the New World.
Right.
And what I think they faced then is working with grapes is so much easier and so cheap, so much less expensive than working with a cow, or pulling corn, or pulling wheat, or working with, you know, agave hearts is just so much easier and so much less expensive than working with cacao. That it didn't make economic sense to them to invest the amount of time required to make it work. And so they just ignored it.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's been a fabulous project in many respects. I mean, we do have that social responsibility aspect working with the farmers,
right.
The environmental responsibility aspect. So in some places where they do centralized fermentation, the pH, the amount of liquid they collect, and the pH level of this stuff, it's so acidic, it's got a level of 3.5, that if you let all of that liquid just drain directly into the streams, it can have an effect on the acid level of the streams and affect the both fish life and the plants which are surrounding the streams and in the waterways. And in some places you have to collect it and, you know, put it into a pond and aerate it and remediate it. So by collecting it and using it to generate alcohol, we actually have the effect of improving the local environment around these collection centers as well.
Full circle, too. I mean, then, you know, eventually your cacao plants are going to yield possibly better fruit with that cycle, with taking those higher acid levels out of the environment and letting the environment do its thing. You're kind of like that it was intended to do. You know, it seems like, you know, it always comes back around to, with the way that we think about distillation and the products that we're making nowadays, there's a little bit more like social responsibility, you know, and mm-hmm. it seems like there's a lot of that involved with this, and it also tastes great.
And it also tastes great. I mean, your point about, you know, what does it taste like? You know, my experience is that I found is that if somebody has, you know, really likes Pisco, then mm-hmm. they'll say, "Ooh, this reminds them of Pisco." Or if somebody's a white rum drinker, it will remind them of rum, or will remind them of somewhere between a tequila and agave, or a grappa, or something like that.
Yeah.
But it really is none of those things,
right?
I mean, but that's hard to put your finger on.
Yeah, that's what we're, you know, like we were saying about 10 minutes ago. It's, you know, it's really fun for me, like, to introduce this to people at my bar, because they're like, they like you just said, they grasp onto another spirit, but it's you know, a thing of its own. And we could say that rye and bourbon, like, they both taste like whiskey, but they're two different things, you know. But right. But it's really cool to see that there's a new spirit on the market, you know, a new spirit category on the market. But you also have a very interesting distillation process, which I think we should take a quick break. And when we get back, let's talk about the we've talked about the harvesting and the fermentation. But let's talk about the distillation when we get back here in a second.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Clay Gordon.
The apothecary don't carry my pills no more. Well, I cursed the gun that popped up in my brain. I healed every subway stop on the subway train. I just needed one place to go. There were signs on every door. Why the apothecary don't carry my pills no more. I got a restless, rambling mind. But I feel like the FDA want me to die.
You are listening to The Apothecary by Brothers NYC. On heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
And we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy and on the phone across the country in San Francisco, correct?
All the way in San Francisco.
You're in San Francisco.
I'm completely and totally not envious of the weather you've been having.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
You know, accidentally, I booked my tickets on the wrong day, so I'm flying back tomorrow rather than today or yesterday. And the number of stories I'm walking around the fancy Fucho and the number of stories of people who just can't get back home.
Oh, man.
It's just huge. Just huge. So I'm here today. I won't tell you how lovely it is. I don't want to depress everybody in New York.
Oh, man. My brother just moved out there about a month ago, and he's been taking screenshots on his iPhone of his, the Weather Channel app, and yeah. I'm like, and sending him to me, and I just say,
Don't rub it in. Yeah, absolutely.
I actually got really lucky in December when the snow hit. I was in Mexico, and then just now, this last week, or actually right now, one of my bar backs is down in Mexico, and I'm like, dude, us bartenders, we know how to time it to get out of the city during the bad weather, you know?
Yeah,
it's a weird bartender intuition.
well, one of the great things I like about this project is I come to this from the world of chocolate, not the world of alcohol,
right?
And so I have these interesting dual roles. So I've been working with the startup team for a little bit over 2 years now. And I helped them locate their suppliers in Peru and in Ecuador. And we're about to bring a new origin online for the next harvest season in the Dominican Republic. But I also have this background in working with chocolate and pastry. And so I am acting as a culinary brand ambassador. So I'm working with the chocolatiers and the pastry chefs and the savory chefs I know to get them to use Sorbezzo as an ingredient in the kitchen, not just in the bar. You talked about its versatility earlier on, and this is one of the things that we're really interested in exploring. You know, if you talk to a mixologist, and they'll say, oh, I have an idea for doing a drink with X, Y, and Z, and they'll go, man, that was invented 100 years ago. Or, you know, it's somebody's doing that now, it's already been done. You know, trying to come up with a truly new cocktail,
it's damn near
using
impossible.
All of the existing base spirits is very difficult. And one of the great things is, you know, I'm sure that you've experienced in your time behind the bar working with Sorbezzo, is we're just at the very beginning at understanding what the potential of this new spirit is in terms of what it can be done and how it can be used, the kinds of flavors that it goes and works with, and how it can be used in drinks and all the complementary things that go around the rituals that are associated with the bar with drinking. So we're just hugely excited. We're having fabulous success in New York City at a lot of different levels, in restaurants, with the bars and mixologists like yourself, who've become sort of early adopters and earlier promoters to the product. And we're just, can't be more excited about, what the next year are going to bring as we bring this to the market and get in the hands of more really talented, really creative people who want to work with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, we're already using it in the kitchen. We're we're using it in a pâté. We're experimenting with it in a pâté. We have our whole pastry department, which, of course, we're always, I like going into the pastry kitchen just to see what's happening in there and maybe get some inspiration, vice versa from the bar to that kitchen. But, especially, like you were saying, it's an open future for this spirit category, especially with cocktails, with food, everything. It has a really great story, and we've only talked about half of that so far. A little bit more than half, I guess, but about the...
There's a 1,000-year history, and we're coming to this and making that connection to and with that history is a part of the challenge that's facing the group, the team right now as we're working to introduce this going forward. One of the things that we have is it's a new category of spirits, so where do you put it on the shelf in a liquor store?
Right.
Because you can't put it, it doesn't fit in the rum category.
I didn't think of that yet.
That's one very, very simple question. When you say cacao to some people, they immediately think chocolate. And so they think this is either a chocolate-flavored vodka or a chocolate liqueur.
And it doesn't...
And there's no chocolate flavor anywhere near this.
Right.
It's the first new category, in 200 years. And that's really cool because it's the first new category and everybody is going, God, I want to be a part of this because it will never happen again in my lifetime. Right? Yeah. So I want to be a part of it. Right. And at the same time, you're going, where do we put it on the shelf? It's just... it's the little mundane issues, which are critically important to the success
right.
of something, which we're currently working through and currently through to make sure that we get it in the right place so that people are looking for it and people who are looking for it can find it when they get it.
Oh man, yeah.
I was just thinking, because it's
an actual spirit. It's not a liqueur, so it wouldn't be on the liqueur section. And you can't really put it, you can't put it in the rum. You can't put it in the brandy. I mean, I guess, you could put it in the brandy section, technically, right?
We fall into the TTP category of what's called a distilled specialty spirit because they don't know what to call it.
Right.
Because we're working with a fruit, a brandy eau de vie,
right.
Is probably the closest category, but it's actually a new fruit. So if you actually look very, very closely at the description of what brandies are, not quite. So this is something that we are really excited to be able to find the answer to. We want to engage with the entire community, bartenders, chefs, chocolatiers, members of the public who are buying the cocktails and buying the bottles. Say, help us figure this out.
Yeah.
Because when we do, it's going to be really, really cool.
Well, if you need any help with, cocktail development for your book or your website or anything.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to be back
two
in New York on Friday,
back.
I'm going to contact you and I want to be in your bar and in your kitchen next week and I'm gonna do a little bit of learning about what it is that you're doing and then being able to provide a little bit of input.
Awesome.
Stuff that I've learned from everybody else.
Cool.
You talked about in the first half, we talked about how it's really important to develop customized collection protocols for each one of the countries that we work with. They all do it differently, or different areas of the country. You really do need to go in there with a certain amount of humility. You just can't say this is the way to do it. You need to respect the local customs.
And how they've been doing it for so long.
Because... these are third and fourth and fifth and sixth and tenth generation cacao farmers.
Right.
They're not going to change their ways overnight. But one of the things that we're learning is that different varieties of cacao produce very different flavored distillates.
Sure.
As you might expect. So not only do we have the difference between, for example, a Chardonnay grape and a Sauvignon grape, right? So just that, you also have the impact of terroir.
Sure.
So the same varietal grown in different places will produce a different product. So some of the bits of learning that we're doing is not only which strains of yeast are we putting together to be able to control the fermentation. So one of the first things we do after we collect the juice is we gently pasteurize it to stop wild fermentation. Mm-hmm. And then we re-inoculate with a mix of yeasts, which is particularly what we're doing, to be able to control the flavors that we get from fermentation. But then by controlling some of the parameters for fermentation, we've learned to be able to take varieties that are considered to be bulk cocoa, not necessarily fine flavor cocoa, and to be able to produce higher, to be able to coax out more nuanced, more delicate, more interesting flavors from them than you would normally expect that you'd be able to. And then for each area that we work with, it's custom distillation protocols. So it's not only what style of still we're using, but what that still is made of, if it has a column associated with it, are there plates in it, where those plates are located, the temperatures that things get run at, all of these things are variables.
Sure.
That we've spent the last couple of years looking at in order to be able to figure out, okay, for this variety in this location, we need to work this kind of style of fermentation with this approach to distilling. And then in Ecuador, it's very different from Peru. And we're expecting that it will be very different in the Dominican Republic as well, because they have a very different, they're working with very different genetics in terms of the bean varieties, as well as differences in the terroir.
Yeah. And speaking of the distillation, don't you guys have a very unique still?
We have different stills in every area that we're working on.
But I believe the one in Peru, isn't there like a gourd involved with it or something like that?
Well, our master distiller is in Peru, and it would be fair to say that we have a cross, which is sort of something between a traditional pisco still and a traditional cognac still. Mm-hmm. With some little stuff that we've done to make it work more for our purposes. But yeah, I mean, we're working with, very different. These are things we're learning. You can't produce Solbeso in the same manner that you produce the base for rum in a continuous column still, for example. You just boil away everything that's interesting about the liquid.
Sure.
Right. And so, yes, I mean, part of the learning that we've been doing, working with our master distiller in Peru, has been getting a much better understanding of what the key variables are and what the tweaks need to be made on them in order to be able to push the liquid in a particular direction. So that we get the flavors that we want. I mean, one of the things we learned very early on is that we can't actually ferment the pulp. There's so much pectin in the pulp that you develop a huge methanol load.
Oh yeah.
And you don't. You need to be very, very careful with this particular fruit as input. Actually, I think that's one of the reasons why people didn't use it before, is because they fermented the pulp and they got this methanol load and they got them sick. And we've learned that's something that you can't do. You have to filter and have to get as much of that fiber out as you possibly can before you start the fermentation process.
So what you're saying is don't try making this at home, basically.
it's one of those things. It's a lot more complicated than making beer. With beer, if you ferment it wrong, you basically get something that smells really bad, and you know right away that it's not going to work. With an alcohol, after you've distilled it, depending on how hard you distill it, and especially if you double or triple distill it, you'll get rid of aromas and you won't know that the methanol is there, and it will hurt you. So you have to be much more technically aware. The level of expertise that's required to distill, one of the things I've learned is that the level of technical expertise that's required to distill safely is more than making wine at home or making beer at home. If you're using fruit, if you're using a simple stock like I'm taking sugar, you know, distilling from sugar is you know, the chances of creating much methanol are very, very low.
Right.
So, yeah, this is a much more complicated process.
Well, speaking of complicated processes, I wanted to know, what's your favorite way to drink it? And I'm being very facetious there, but how do you like to enjoy this spirit?
One of the things which really intrigues me about Solbeso, and one of the experiences I try to share with people that I'm introducing it to for the first time, is to try it neat and then pour just a tiny amount of water into it.
Sure.
One of the things that's really different about Solbeso as a white spirit is that it opens up when you add water or ice like a good single malt does.
Yeah.
So it softens on the nose, it softens on the palate, it opens up and brings out aromas that aren't necessarily there before you add the water. Drinking it simple like that, just a little bit of water, is probably one of my favorite ways to do it. And then lemon and lime. Great citrus enhance the fruity floral aromas that are in it. And you may have noticed this with your playing behind the bar. When you start playing with a pH, mm-hmm. It also changes. And so whether you're doing that with fruit or whether you're doing it by adding a citrate, or as an ingredient, it really does change the nature of the spirit entirely. So it's used as the primary spirit. But we don't think of this as a replacement for vodka or tequila or anything like that. But you know, it does make a dynamite margarita or a michelada. It does make a dynamite sunrise. But we're never going to suggest to people. Yeah. That it is a replacement for any of those things. We're looking for people to take it and, push the envelope and have fun creatively with it.
So
even though it does work as a fabulous replacement for most white spirits in traditional cocktails.
Yeah, we've been doing like caipirinhas. We've been doing, you always do like the daiquiri test with any like white spirit, you know, like the gimlet test. Anytime like a new white rum comes around, you always do the, you know, everyone does the daiquiri test. But but with this one, since it's got like kind of a, you know, I liken it more to like an unaged brandy, you know. So I did an Alexander with it, and I got to tell you, especially with the cacao, you know, Solbeso Alexander. I don't know how many people out there like, you know, drinks with cream in them, but. You know, let me rephrase. Everyone likes that drink, but it was awesome.
I mean, one of the ways that I enjoyed it while I was here at the Fancy Food Show is there's a small company located in Texas, but their sales office is in New York, and they import their product up from Mexico, and they're doing not only a mole but a wonderful, real, you know, true Mexican style hot chocolate. So chocolate, which is designed to be grated and melted. And throwing Solbeso into a hot chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, killer. Killer. Especially if you have a chocolate which is unalkalized. And so it still has the fruitiness, the fruit acid. It's really quite remarkable. So a hot chocolate or an iced hot chocolate, right, made with Solbeso over the top of it is a great way to go. You know, we have a chef. In a restaurant down on Avenue C that's working with this, and he makes a granita from the Solbeso and puts it on top of oysters. I mean, I love it sprinkled on top of ceviche. It just does wonders for that. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. As somebody who's, you know, comes more from the culinary world and is learning about the world of specialty spirits and cocktails, just the creative. I mean, I've started working with purple corn. So instead of making a chicha morada, You know, I just make an extraction of the blue corn, water, and then make a pineapple simple syrup, which is spiced with all the spices you'd find in the Chicha Morada.
Nice.
And then being able to combine them so I can control the level of sweetness, and then putting Solpeso in there.
All right. Enough talk about this, Clay. when you get back, we got to get a drink and some food, because I'm dying right now. But where can the listeners learn more about Solpeso?
Well, I mean, there's a website, solpeso.com, where they can learn a little bit more. We're still in semi-stealth mode. We're focused on New York City and New York State as a market right now, working with a group of early adopters that we've identified both in restaurants and in bars to help us really understand what people want to know and how to present it.
Yeah, the application.
Right. So they could go to solpeso.com, /order, and they can have it ordered for delivery on the island of Manhattan or anywhere in New York State or the 25 states where it's legal to ship alcohol from New York. And there are a couple of locations in New York City where it's also available for retail sale.
Awesome. Clay, it's been so nice talking to you, man. Hit me up when you're in New York City again.
I will do that. Damon, thanks. Thanks for inviting me on today.
All right, man. Hey, my pleasure. All right. Well, check out Solpeso, and also check out the Speakeasy next week. I've got a good old friend of mine coming into the studio, and it's probably going to get pretty ridiculous in here, so be sure to check that out. That's it this week. Cheers.
With your rock and roll, Lord knows that country music's gonna save.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.